Yesterday, the former chief scientist for the Exxon Valdez oil spill trustee council said he thinks physically the environment has recovered except for a couple of species, but psychologically we know that marks remain, and we're still talking about dispersants 25 years later. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Pre-authorization for dispersant use in some Alaska's waters is being discussed in tribal consultation. Statewide and toll-free, our phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call on Anchorage 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
The Deepwater Horizon blowout created a situation in which decisions had to be made very fast, and one of the decisions was to use an enormous amount of dispersants. In a sense, we had a laboratory there in the Gulf of Mexico for the colossal scale use of dispersants. And what the outcome of all that is, you would think, would be something that we knew, but I find the scientists have huge differences of opinion about whether this was damaging, and if so, how damaging, and to whom, and how, and what went into sediments, and what went where, fate and effects, and so on and so forth. It's like this huge chemical biological mystery, and it gets more complicated the deeper you look into it. And I talk to these scientists and say, how can you have such huge disagreements about this? And they say it's really a huge thing, and it's not so unusual that people see something. You know, I see this part of the elephant, it's the trunk, and they see that part of the elephant, and it's the foot, and we seem like we're talking about two different things. It's just so big that there are all these different aspects and facets to it. But the fact remains that what people who have to decide about responding to spills see is that it was effective, and hence it's being talked about as a viable method of responding to spills in Alaska. And we can't really answer the question, is that good or not? But we can at least move the discussion ahead. And that's what I'd like to try to do. Originally, we were going to have the regional response team, which advises the federal unseen coordinator about oil spill response, but they've declined the invitation to participate in the program. They are continuing with their tribal consultation process, and most of what I know is coming out of the consultation process, but also they do have a website, and the basic information about pre-authorization of dispersant use is contained on that website, and it's easy to find and not all that hard to read. Our telephone number then is 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. And basically, I've recruited some experts to be panelists and talk with you in the areas that you choose to talk about, and I'll give you some idea who our panelists are. First, I turn to Tulane University, where Vijay John, who is a chemical engineer and is chairing the Consortium for the Molecular Engineering of Dispersant Systems. He joins us by telephone. Vijay, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. I look forward to it.
And sitting across from me is John French, formerly a research professor at University of Alaska School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, and a marine toxicologist, and now the proprietor of Pegasus Environmental Solutions, Alaska. Lives down in Seward and is well known in the marine toxicology field. John, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve, and thanks for hosting this topic. As you indicated, I think it's an important topic for all Alaskans to be aware of.
Yeah. John, I'm going to start with you with this part here. I remember when Fran Ulmer was appointed to the to investigate the Deepwater Horizon, and you came up from Seward, had Fran very nicely called an open public meeting, said, let's get Alaskans to tell me what I should carry to this investigation. And you were among the more vocal. And one of the things you were talking about is dispersants. How do you feel that investigation came out?
Well, as you indicated, the Deepwater Horizon response was the first of its kind. There's never been that basically unfettered use of chemical dispersants in any previous oil spill, especially not the deepwater injection. And, you know, it's very, very difficult to judge what the real effects were and weren't. And if you can indulge me for a minute, I'd like to go back to the Exxon Valdez spill. And there, it took us, the spill, of course, happened in March 1989, and it took us till 93 and 94 to really get a good scientific hold on some of the effects on some of the species, particularly some of the seabird species. And the worst was with pink salmon and Pacific herring. And, you know, the mechanisms of action and why that toxicity took place have now been fairly well resolved, but that information that was built up over those 20 plus years has basically still not reached into the regulatory realm, which means it's really not being given equal consideration in writing oil spill response strategies.
And then I think the treatment that the report ended up giving to dispersants is simply to say, well, it probably was a good decision, and not really go too much further than that. Yeah. as I can tell, reading of it.
It did. At least short term, get a lot of the oil off the surface or prevent it from reaching the surface, depending on how you want to translate it. But the feedback I get from people that live in the spill area is that there's still oil that's coming up as tarballs on the beach. There are still occasionally mats that are coming up. There's studies of various macrofauna. Perhaps the most concerning to me is the one with bottlenose dolphins, which, you know, there was a study a year after the spill that suggested in Bhattacharya Bay, at least, that a number of the dolphins were very seriously impacted on a physiological level by the spill. Whether it was the oil or the oil plus the dispersant or the dispersant alone is open for debate.
Right. And then, you know, you can also have a comparison of the AT pod of killer whales.
Correct.
In Alaska, which is probably going to go extinct eventually because they haven't been reproducing for an awfully long time now. And you can also argue about how it's linked to the spill or not. But when you're a top predator like that, and there's all that toxicity coming up the food chain at you.
The other effect with the bottlenose dolphins is they have what's called an unusual mortality event, a UME. And that's actually still been going on through December last year. That's the last month's data set. And this seems to be disproportionately affecting newborn bottlenose dolphins, stillborn, aborted, otherwise, you know, quite newly born. And these are officially strandings, but they're almost all dead. And so, yeah, the translation that those of us that are somewhat naysayers would say is that we're seeing a reproductive failure event, which is very much what Craig Matkin and the AT killer pod showed up here.
Yeah. I'm going to turn now to V.J. John, a chemical engineer at Tulane. You're at Tulane, not too far from the coast, right?
Right. It's right in our backyard.
And do you, John says his colleagues are telling him they still see tarballs. Do you see that?
Yes. Well, I don't. It's a long way to the coast. It's full of marshes and swamps. But I do know people who work in cleanup, and every once in a while they are called to investigate observances of tarballs, and it's usually after a storm, and they do seize evidence every once in a while. But the other aspect that I also hear is that for the most part, the at least the coastline looks cleaned up. There's most of the visual evidence of the oil spill has gone.
Mm. Used to live on the Gulf Coast down in Texas. And in Galveston, we had brown sand. And that was probably because of, offshore seeps and so forth like that. And we had tar balls. And you went on down to Corpus Christi, and the sand was nice and white. And that's no longer the case because they had a couple of huge spills offshore, and then they had their tar balls, and their sand turned brown. What color is your sand now? It used to be white.
Everything. Well, I don't know that. Everything in the coast of Louisiana is brown. It's muddy, the Mississippi.
Oh, that's right. So, Louisiana. What was I thinking? I'm thinking about Pensacola, Biloxi.
Right. I think that the beaches have come back. I mean, people are using the beaches.
Uh-huh.
I have no idea. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, BJ. Now I want to get you to kind of explain what you're actually doing, because it's kind of a mouthful to say a consortium for the molecular engineering of dispersant systems. But as I understand it, this is getting into the basic chemistry of dispersants, how they work, why they work, and what's actually going on molecularly, and how could it then be engineered, right?
Sure. I'll be happy to explain a little bit of a historical aspect. After the Deepwater Horizon, BP put in a significant amount of money, $500 million over 10 years, to study the impact of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And this is a 10-year project, $50 million per year for 10 years. There was an organization set up called GOMRI, stands for the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, and it's run by a research board of very eminent scientists. There was a call for proposals, as part of the funding program, they funded 8 consortia, and there's a very good website which talks about all of this. It's gomri.org, and listeners can easily access it to learn more about it. One of the consortia they funded, most of the consortia are run by very distinguished ecologists, oceanographers, who take trips out to the Gulf of Mexico, collect samples, understand the fate of the oil, where the look at the sediments, look at coastlines, look at organisms, look at fish, different species. Our consortium, the consortium that we were funded on, is in an entirely different perspective. We are a group of, actually, there's 22 institutions, half of them, maybe 14 of them, located in the 5 Gulf states, and the others are very distinguished institutions, research institutions spread around the country. The group of investigators are either chemists or chemical engineers, a few physicists, a few environmental engineers, and the objective here is to really understand how dispersants work from a molecular, a nanoscale perspective. You're looking right at the oil-water interface. And our premise is that in the 40 years, I mean, the most standard dispersant used is something called Colrex at 9500. It was developed by ExxonMobil, manufactured through Nalco, which is now part of Ecolabs. The idea is that there's still a lot to be learned about how CoreExit works on the molecular scale, how these components of these dispersants, which are really detergent molecules in solvents, how they function, how they break up the oil. In the past 40 years, since CoreExit was developed, there have been tremendous tools in computation, in electron microscopy, in a variety of other experimental and theoretical techniques that will allow people to understand what's going on, and as a consequence, develop new ideas, new kinds of dispersants. We may not be able to use it for the next oil spill if it happens the next couple of years, but the idea is 10 to 20 years from now, if we could have better technologies or a better understanding of how these currently used dispersants work. So that, in a nutshell, is the mission of this consortium for the molecular engineering of dispersant systems. We do not focus on toxicology. There are two toxicologists in the team that help us do initial toxicological studies, but we defer to the EPA and other agencies for full-scale toxicological expertise.
Okay, thank you. That's very good and compact. And I really kind of want to ask you if it doesn't drive you a little bit crazy that Exxon won't disclose its exact formula for this. I know that you know what's in it, but you don't know how much of what.
That's right.
And is that a problem?
That's not so much a problem to the chemists and the engineers, because you can start approaching the compositions that give you the same values of something called the interfacial tension. That's the standard measurement that allows you to figure out whether a dispersant can easily break up the oil. From that perspective, it's not that much of a problem. But I think for the ecologists and the people who want to study the impacts of adding dispersants, knowing the amounts of each could be important.
One engineering possibility, a couple of them that we talked about, when I checked in with you before the show. One was that it might be possible to create a kind of a sand that would make a different type of broken up oil. And the other one you talked about was using dispersants and other substances in a way that could herd oil, which is, you know, perks up the ears of people that are worried about broken ice and oil that might show up in broken ice.
Yeah, so there are natural phenomena. There are observations that sediment, it's in the literature, sediments can stabilize oil droplets. It's called oil mineral aggregates. And there's a group of people working in our consortium who are trying to develop that into new kinds of dispersants that don't use detergents, but use natural sediments, use clays, because these things actually these solid materials actually come to the oil-water interface. They settle down there. They are very stable, and they prevent the oil droplets from coalescing into large globules that will come back to the surface.
And if I can just interrupt here, John French, what would that do in terms of the toxicology situation? In other words, if you have these little droplets that will tend to reconsolidate, and you have this soap, which, as I understand, one of the toxicology concerns of that is that it can actually increase how bioactive some of these toxic things in the oil are.
Yes, certainly, and that is one of the critical questions about traditional dispersant use, the surfactant-based, detergent-based dispersants. And yes, they create small sizes, that particles under 50 microns for the most part, whereas the physically dispersed in, from wave action are usually up around 300. So they're much smaller. They're much more the right size to catch on gill rakers or baleen or whatever. And they also have more surface area, so there can be more dissolution of some of the aromatic compounds that the toxicologists have begun to become much more concerned about. But the other aspect is that, you know, oil is not just one substance, and some people tend to try to ignore that on occasion. Some of the people doing what they call petroleumics, looking at the whole composition of crude oil, have suggested there may be as many as 50,000 different compounds in crude oil, of which we only know the toxicology of maybe a few hundred, at most 1,000. So we only know the toxicology of a very small fraction. And we do know that some of the heavier fractions, the more aromatic fractions, and we now are beginning to know that part of the resin fraction, which we used to think was high boiling, well, it is high boiling, but because it was high boiling, that it was large molecular weight and wouldn't be bioavailable. And we're beginning to see that that's not the case. So what the real question is becoming is, how are these different classes of oil compounds interacting with the detergents in the traditional dispersant or with the mineral aggregates in formation of OMA? And actually, I think formation of OMA in Alaska waters might be actually be important locally, because as you know, some nearshore waters have a lot of glacial silt in it.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Vijay, I want to get back to you in a few more of the frontiers you're exploring with your consortium.
Sure.
Yes, go ahead, Vijay.
The other topic you mentioned was this concept of herding, Steve, and that's another technology we're interested in. It also ties in with the dispersant. In terms of herding, you may have in YouTube, there's this little video of I guess it's a middle school science experiment of dropping a little Dawn soap behind a paper boat and that moving the boat. That's a phenomenon which in physics is called the Marangoni effect. It's the ability of a detergent to create a gradient of something called a surface tension and drive things based on this gradients of surface tensions. So in the same way, if one takes a little drop of crude oil and just puts it on water, it's very fascinating to see how fast the oil will spread. Okay, if the oil spreads and it becomes too thin, it's very difficult to pick up in a skimming system or even if application of dispersants, it spreads a lot, tremendously. So the idea here is to be able to corral the oil, to be able to use the same concept by applying detergents and driving the oil into a compact mass. And if you can make the mass a thickness of 3 millimeters or approximately 3 millimeters, it is easy to much easier to skim, or in the open ocean, it's easier to burn. What we are looking at are technologies where, again, you have a window of opportunity of about 15 minutes before which the oil spreads again and you lose that impact. So some of the technologies that we are using is using very natural biopolymers from things like cactus mucilage, from crabs and shrimp shells. This is a polymer called chitosan. We modify it slightly, and what these polymers do is they actually keep the oil that you have herded or corralled. It keeps the oil in a compact mass, and it allows you to then very easily develop the skimming technologies or the burning technologies. So the same concept can be used also to stabilize little drops of oil and cut down the use of detergent-based dispersants, hopefully. Now, what John is saying is absolutely right. We have no idea about what impact this has on making the aromatics in the oil more available to organisms or less available to organisms and so on, to important flora and fauna in the marine environment. We don't know that yet, but it's part. We have people actually looking at bacteria, looking at how bacteria anchor themselves to the oil-water interface and how that may help or hinder the bacteria from consuming the oil.
I think Vijay, thank you. I think we need to make clear now that we're talking about frontier research. We're not talking about an actual product that is on the shelf. It's a product that would be several years out, if at all. It might not even work. But still, I'm loving the way that you're discussing some of these frontiers of potential ways of holding, of dealing with spills, because essentially, we all know it's been like, almost 40 years now, and there's been no change in the Corexit. So the idea that somebody might come up with something else is pretty fascinating to me, and especially this idea of some kind of engineering that would actually make maybe keep the oil from being toxic to the life forms that it would be toxic to, and yet very available for the organisms that really like to eat oil to make it more available to them. That would be really something. It would be a reversal of entropy almost in the biological front. I want to go down to Dr. Hilgard, who is called in from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, thank you.
So tell me.
I was calling from Washington, D.C.,
yes.
And I was interested in just hearing your discussion about what was going on in Alaska, and I have been following the BP Gulf oil situation.
Uh-huh.
And wanted to see what you're doing that we're not going to have a repeat in performance in Alaska, having the same setup for allowing the same products and the same situations to occur one more time.
Well, I don't think we've attained that, Dr. Hilgard.
No, I know. That's why I'm on the call.
All right. Well, what would you suggest?
I'm just here to listen today.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Feel free to stay on the line there, and we'll move on to another call. Down at the end of the Kenai Peninsula, Charlie joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Charlie.
Good morning, Steve. A good program. The big question I have is, how do we get the oil companies to tell us the truth of the volume that we're dealing with here? You know, I just found the paperwork yesterday that Finley Abbott worked up on the Exxon Valdez that proves it was 28.5 million gallons, not 11 million gallons.
Thanks for bringing that up, Charlie. I'm glad Dr. Spees actually put that 11 million number up on the board at the Marine Science Symposium yesterday, you know, and it just sort of keeps going around, and there's very little basis for that estimate.
If we tell a lie often enough, people are hoping it's going to become a lie. And so if we don't know the volume of the oil that we're dealing with, because oil companies won't tell us, what else are they not telling us? And it's these little keys that it might be hold the secret to the answer to our question here, but we don't get all the exact the straight information from the oil company. So how do we make them tell us the straight information?
Well, maybe, you know, that seems like it could be directed to the regional response team.
Yeah, we need the government.
It seems that, you know, they would be the ones that could had the power to crack the whip. Charlie.
Yes, because the quantity of a product that we're dealing with in the environment is going to have a direct response or a direct relationship to the amount of dispersants, the type of dispersants, and everything. If we don't have the basic information, the rest of it's just foolishness, isn't it?
Well, you got to get no argument from this panel here, Charlie. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good program.
Okay, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, and the email is talk@alaskapublic.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Alaska's public schools have new standards in English and math, setting high expectations for students. Students who meet these goals will be ready for success after high school, whether in the military, on the job, or in an apprenticeship, technical school, or college. Ask your school for parent guides to the standards or learn more online at education.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
I see that Rick Steiner, our past guest a few times on this show, has weighed in and saying it's all just a distraction from the basic issue you don't want to be spilling in the first place. And it's all a distraction. He thinks it's not constructive to be discussing this sort of thing. But we need to keep up to date on the science. I'm sorry. I just really think we do. We have with us John French of Pegasus Environmental Solutions, longtime professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, actually in Kodiak, and also V.J. John of Tulane University, who is chairman of the Consortium for the Molecular Engineering of Dispersant Systems. And that was created under the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, basically with some of the BP funds from the Deepwater Horizon, and they are turning that research, that money, into basic research into the molecular nature of dispersants and possibilities of trying to advance the field. Let's go now to Chris, who joins the program from Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chris.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for running the show. It's a benefit to the public here.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, I think, that the regional response team chose to decline to appear on the show, but I was not about to not have a show just because they wouldn't come on.
Thank you for holding it. I appreciate it. What we do know now is that there are very real benefits to the coastal biosphere and very arguable benefits to the area around a spill where dispersants are used. The fact that you would sacrifice a known benefit for a possible harm, in my opinion, is unsound, hurtful to the public, to the biosphere, and very bad public policy. Remember, the state of Alaska twiddled its thumbs for three bluebird days after the Exxon Valdez, when they weren't allowed to burn or use dispersants. And when the authorization finally came from DEC Commissioner Kelso, the wind just blew the slick all over areas that we are now cleaning, that 30, 40% or 25% could have been helped if they had had that authorization right at the first minute. So I think it's terrible public policy to not use dispersants when you know you can benefit the coast. Thanks, Steve.
So you say a benefit that you know is to the near area, and the drawbacks are?
Possible.
Possible, unknown, so take the known. Is that it?
We certainly should have had huge known and viewable impacts. If dispersants were such a bad thing in the Gulf Coast spill, we should be able to see it readily, clearly, without any microscope. But we would have saved, up here in Valdez, we would have saved tremendous areas if dispersants and burning had been allowed in those first three bluebird days.
Well, I'm not going to argue about the burning, although I know they did try a little bit of it and it smoked out to Titlick, and that stopped that. But I also know that they tried a little dispersants, and there was so little wave action that it didn't seem to do anything.
It was a failed public policy, as bad, almost as much as Exxon's poor response.
It was Alyeska's poor response. Chris, here's how it worked. The barge would have tipped over if they tried to recover the oil. The barge would have tipped over. It had to have a bulkhead put in it. That's a fact. And that was Alyeska. And Alyeska is the one that had the booms that were all stuck underneath the snowbank and didn't have the equipment to move the things. It was all Alyeska. It was not Exxon. Exxon got involved. They wanted to spray dispersions right away. There was no wave action. It wouldn't have done anything, Chris.
Oh, no. Disagree. There would have been something, Steve.
I don't. The observation was contrary, and I talked personally to Denny Kelso and those people as they watched it. It simply didn't do anything.
A convenient excuse for the state to waste 3 days of bluebird weather, and then the wind picked up, and you know what happened.
All right, Chris.
Okay, take care. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. I just won't have factual disputes on this program. There's no way. The facts are the facts. It's just the way it is. Let's go to Ken, joins program from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ken.
Hello.
Hi.
I have recreated boating out in Prince William Sound since 1978, and I worked the oil spill in 89. And I was a part of the crew, the skiff crew that worked the Corexit experiment on Smith Island. It was in August. It was one of the only experiments, I think, in using Corexit. And we had a very interesting encounter there with that chemical. I'm not sure. I'd like to have it confirmed. Was it Corexit 9500 that was used on Smith Island?
It most likely was, because that's the saltwater version.
Well, actually, the one that was and actually still is stockpiled in Alaska is 9527, although most of the 9527 actually got shipped down to the Gulf and has been used there. But I did have a question to ask you to clarify. On Smith Island, was it a surface washing agent? Because there were two Corexits that were used, and one was a surface washing agent, and the other one was the normal dispersant.
It was the surface washing agent that was used.
Yeah.
And that agent did a very good job of cleaning up the sand and the rocks and everything else. The beach was already dead. But from the skiff perspective and from the perspective of trying to sop up the oil, there was absolutely nothing could be corralled. And when it left all the booms and all of the skimmers, it resurfaced very shortly after exiting. I think it was because of the hot water that was on the beach itself. It would simply just resurface in almost the same globules, the very high paraffin North Slope crude that we have. So I just felt that it was moving the problem further down to other areas.
Yeah, Ken. And of course, I think Smith Island, you know, looking at the map, it really got heavily hammered.
Oh, yeah. Everything was dead on that whole portion of Smith Island. But, for instance, Little Smith Island was just a ways down from that. And the dispersant was obviously washing up on portions of that and then further down towards Night Island and south of it. So that was my perspective on it, that perhaps the paraffin base of the North Slope crude is just renders the chemical something else. It was returned into crude and then floated on to new areas, perhaps not oil. That was what I got out of working the actual chemical.
Ken, thanks a lot for that firsthand observation. I want to turn to VJ John down in Tulane about this paraffin issue. And it's like you probably know, Alaska North Slope crude does have this higher waxy content.
Right. I don't know enough about what happened to Smith at Smith Island to make an informed judgment.
Of course. No, that's not the question. It's more a question of his theory that he was making, that it might be the Corexit was simply not effective against it. It was just making it go on downstream or, you know, down current. It seems possible, doesn't it?
If there is insufficient agitation, you will not break up the oil into small enough droplets. It's necessary. I mean, you have to have sufficient wave action if you want to use a dispersant to break up the oil.
Right.
In terms of corralling the oil, Corexit may not be the best it's not really a dispersant at that point. Let's call it a herder. Corexit may not be the best herder to corral the oil. To my knowledge, people have not optimized the best herders yet. There's a whole field out there that's waiting to be developed.
I can see that in a research field, and hopefully you guys in the consortium will be working on that for us. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org, and it's a local phone call if you're in Anchorage at 550-8422. I think I forgot to mention that. We have V.J. John of the Consortium for the Molecular Engineering of Dispersant Systems, and John French, a marine toxicologist, with us here live on the program. We're talking about dispersants, and one of the reasons we're doing that is that the regional response team would like, it actually has pre-authorization, but it wants to clarify pre-authorization for the use of dispersants in certain Alaska waters. Now, as I understand it, they're talking about deeper waters, or trying to talk about deeper waters, and they're talking about the idea that if you get a bunch of wave action, dispersants may be the only thing you really can do because booms are not going to be effective. John, you can't really dispute that, can you?
Me?
Yeah, John French.
No, and you know, you look at the proposed dispersant use guidelines, and the proposed pre-authorization area basically stretches from the Copper River Delta all the way out to the end of the Aleutians and back along the north side. But it's, as Steve said, it's primarily a deep water pre-authorization zone. It runs from 24 miles offshore to out to the territorial limit, the 200 miles. And, you know, this causes concern to me because it includes almost all of the continental slope area, which, if you look at the oceanography, actually is where a lot of the nutrients come up into the surface waters. But I'm not sure we have time to discuss that here.
No, but it's I think it's very interesting. In other words, you're saying just because it's deep water doesn't mean that it's not ecologically delicate, especially if the stuff drops down to where there's upwelling taking place and where there's a whole lot of microorganisms feeding.
The upwelling goes all the way up to the surface and at least up into the photic zone. And if I had a way of illustrating pictures over the airwaves, I could show you that there's high levels of primary productivity followed by high levels of secondary productivity in these zones that extend from anything from about 5 miles offshore to well beyond 24 miles, in some cases up to 100 miles offshore. So, you know, especially as you get out to the Aleutians where there's virtually no other nutrient inputs, you have to consider the fact that it really is the offshore, the ocean nutrients that are driving these unlike ecosystems in most of the lower 48.
We have one thing that you have in the Gulf of Mexico that we may actually have also in Alaska waters, there's some indication, is you actually do already have oil-eating bacteria. You know, certainly there were so many oil seeps down in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, and it's pretty well known now that they have, there's critters that eat that. And we have a similar situation. There's a story running this morning about hydrocarbons in Cook Inlet, and Kachemak Bay has a lot of these fat molecules down there. There's probably things that eat that.
there are definitely oil-eating bacteria. It's been said they're ubiquitous. I would have a hard time arguing that. There are certainly many more seeps and sources of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, both from the deepwater seeps, which I've been told with no substantiation that more than half the seeps in U.S. waters are in the Gulf of Mexico. The other aspect is that a lot of hydrocarbons and hydrocarbon-related wastes come down the major river systems there, not the least of which is the Mississippi. If you look at NOAA's Status and Trends Program, sometimes better known as the Muscle Watch Program, why the level of hydrocarbons down there are far, far higher than they are in Alaska. We do have oil-eating bacteria here. The question eventually becomes, do oil-eating bacteria eat all the oil, or do they selectively eat the parts of the oil that are easiest to degrade?
Thank you, John French. Thank you so much. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVimaging.com. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Well, there's a correspondence been sent to me by Bruce Wright, who's a frequent listener to the program, sometimes a guest and chief scientist for the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association. It consists of a letter that Dmitry Filimonov wrote to the regional response team in the context of tribal consultation, saying, I don't have confidence in the federal government to make the right decisions for tribes or Aleutian Pribilof Island Association. Accordingly, pre-authorization for the use of dispersants of unknown and proprietary chemicals is not supported by our organization. Furthermore, during an oil spill, use of dispersants should only be considered on a case-by-case basis and with consensus by the tribes whose resources may be affected. That's just a little section of this longer letter from the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. And indeed, they are open for comment, the regional response team, and what they're looking at is pre-authorization of dispersants, which I suppose would be the idea that they could do it without consultation. Let's go to Don, who joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Thank you, Steve. Your previous gentleman who spoke there, Mr. French, was going right into what I was wanting to inject some comment on regarding the various types of bacteria that eat and consume oil and whatnot, and whether or not they're fussy eaters. There was a TV station here about 30 years ago, Channel 7 KKM. It ran a series by a gentleman named Jacques Cousteau, who was notorious for doing research all over the globe, in the Philippines, Antarctica, the Mediterranean especially, taking core samples in a place called the English Channel. He was astounded when he got to the coast of his own homeland in France. He found there was so much of the fishing that was depleted, it was gone, still four decades after World War II. And when they went down to the bottom, what they found was that there was still a carpet of oil on the bottom. Much of the oil that they thought had been burned off had actually just sunk down to the bottom. Nothing was being consumed. Four decades later, nothing was growing. The fish had nothing down there to eat. The other connection relative to that, there are a lot of things where we have to go back to old science, and I'm sure many of the natives will tell you the same thing. When you overlook things and it gets out of hand and you forget to branch off into various areas to try and solve your problems, it's time to adapt what a fellow got kicked out of school as a delinquent. I mean, Thomas Edison came out with some years later. There's a better way. Find it.
There's a better way. Find it. Thanks a lot for that, Don.
Yes, sir. You're welcome. Have a good day.
All right. Yeah, I kind of had not really thought about that World War II and oil sinking, but that was a long time ago, and yet I can remember on Kodiak Island when the NOAA people went to Kodiak and stood up there and said, "Well, the oil doesn't sink." Somebody came in with a net and said, "Well, what's this on my net?" Yeah, it does. It doesn't take that much to make it sink. So I guess, VJ, John, you kind of go along with what Don is saying. You're the people that are looking for something better.
Yeah, we're trying to understand what are the factors that make oil sink, under what conditions that you could have oil that would be trapped. There's this thing that John would know about called the marine snow, which are really biopolymers that are present in the ocean. They are exopolymers, as they call it, polysaccharides. It's possible that combination of marine snow with sediment grains and oil trapped in there could sink the oil, because you allow the oil, the mass, to have a greater density than water. So there are people in our consortium who are looking at these things in minute detail. There's good fluid mechanics there. People looking at how these things move. What is the ability of these things to stay suspended in the water column, or sink, or rise to the top. It will take a few years to understand it, but I think that having some of the best academic minds from non-traditional, from disciplines like physics and chemistry that haven't usually looked at what's happening in the ocean in this context, I think we can solve some of these problems. I'm optimistic.
You know, you brought that up about the marine snow, and I was thinking you're probably acquainted with Samantha Joy's observations of that.
Sure.
Yeah, quite huge quantities, she was saying.
Sure.
Yeah.
Again, we don't know the mechanisms that cause these things.
Gotcha. So, but the idea that it was a polymer, and that it was a polymer and it was biologically created, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are lots of these huge amounts of exopolymers, they call it, in the sea, yeah, in the oceans.
Let's go to Ken, joins the program in Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ken.
Hi, guys. Just trying to find out a little question here about dispersants. How potent, compared to Dawn soap, is a dispersant as far as harshness and environmentally? Do they actually have a study that tells about how these, whatever they're made of, dispersants are affecting?
Ken, that's a great question. VJ, I'm going to throw that one right to you. I know Dawn is pretty effective.
Yes, actually, there are some studies, again, put out by the oil industry. So, you'll have to take it at its face value. But they're good studies that have compared, very clearly compared, the individual ingredients of Corexit with Dawn soap, and found the individual ingredients to be much less toxic. If you wish.
My more important question I'd like to throw out would be, hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah.
I thought I got cut off there. I was just saying the more important question is what goes on with the cesium that's coming from Fukushima?
Oh, that's next week. That'll be next week, Ken. We're doing that next week. Seriously.
That's great, because that's more concern of anything, because I've heard reports of the whole West Coast is starting to die off because of that.
I think I can safely say that's an exaggeration, but you just tune in next week and we'll really try and get much deeper into that one.
Maybe you can go for 3 hours on that one. We need a little time.
You can go for a month, man. Thanks a lot for your call, Ken. And that is so interesting. You were talking about, Vijay, you were talking about industry-funded research. Of course, your research is industry-funded, but it's totally running through an independent board, so the industry has no way of driving that research. But nonetheless, Bob Spies was talking about this type of, because he was the chief scientist for the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and he was comparing their science with the science that was funded by Exxon. And he said what it mostly turns out to be is asking a different question. You know, it's all in how you ask the question, what question you're asking, what kind of answer you're going to get.
Right.
And so it's, they are, the studies then have credibility, but only credibility within the frame of the question that was asked.
Right.
I think that's, even John's nodding his head on that one. Let's go down to Bruce, joins the program from Homer. Not much time left here, Bruce. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Okay, well, I've done oil spill response drills, and we're trained to round up the corral the oil. You know, I'm a fisherman, and we tow the oil booms, and they've gotten pretty good oil booms now with the current busters and everything. And when I was shocked that they use so much dispersant in the Gulf of Mexico, so I Googled effective dispersed oil on herring. And it came up with a Royal Academy of Science article from Sweden from 1976 that said that dispersed oil was 100 times as effective at killing herring larvae as just the plain oil floating on the surface.
I think that is true.
Yeah, perhaps even more than 100 times.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the matter is there's probably quite a bit more adverse effects that are in peer review right now coming out of the Gulf of Mexico that we'll be hearing of as time goes on. There just aren't that many yet, though. I will say that.
Well, I'll be interested. I'll be watching with keen interest. I'm glad you have this show.
Do you know the journal Environmental Science and Technology? There's a recent paper in this January from Adams and Peter Hodson at Queen's University, and they specifically look at the toxicity on herring. I think Steve has your contact information. I can send it to you offline.
Yeah. Bruce, I want to thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
All right. And the rest of the callers we're not going to be able to get to because we have plumb run out of time. Vijay, John, I want to thank you so much for being a good sport. I know this is not easy for you, and I really appreciate you participating.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. And John French, it was great to finally have you as a guest on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Fukushima is coming up next week. I'm not kidding about that. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.